With so many talented people losing their jobs this past year, it's hard not to think about the song The Music and the Mirror from the musical A Chorus Line, where Cassie begs to be given a chance to work. All I ever needed is the music and the mirror and the chance to dance for you.
The pioneering musical was created in New York City in the early 70s during an economic downturn when a lot of actors and dancers were out of work. When the performers showed up, many of them didn't know that it would be a workshop where they'd be asked to bare their souls and turn their personal stories into what would become a chorus line.
Today, actor, singer, dancer, model John Marshall Jr. joins us to take a look at the songs from A Chorus Line, through his own experience in being in the legendary show and his career as a musical theater performer.
Are the dancers really expected to learn all those moves in seconds?
Is everyone beautiful at the ballet?
What happens when you feel nothing during an acting class with a mean acting teacher?
And how far will tits and ass get you? I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. That is Donna McKechnie singing The Music and the Mirror from the 1975 original Broadway recording of A Chorus Line.
Hello.
Hello, this is Fausto Fernos.
And I'm Mark Fillion from Feast of Fun. Are you ready for your audition?
I'll do my very best.
I need you to be honest, John Marshall Jr., for this podcast.
Raw honesty is what we need.
I think I can handle that.
Tell us your name and what was your first job?
My whole name's John Andrew Marshall Jr. My dad is actually John Andrew Marshall, so he's senior and I'm junior.
And the reason I'm acting so strange is because I'm trying to be very meta here with A Chorus Line.
I'm obsessed with Chorus Line.
Okay, I was saying this felt a little more formal than our last chat so far.
Well, that's the thing about, you know, this past year, it's felt very much similar to Donna McKechnie's song, The Music in the Mirror, where these really talented, amazing people in every job in the world have been chomping at the teeth just to be able to shine, just to be able to do their job. President Trump leaves office with the record number of unemployment since the Great Depression. So there are millions of people who are out of work right now.
And a lot of people dead.
And dead. 400,000 people dead.
And today,
I thought it'd be kind of uplifting and fun to talk to a young actor, singer, dancer, model from Chattanooga, Tennessee, who's actually been in A Chorus Line.
Yes, it's definitely one of those shows that's on the list of one of the greats to get done if you're an actor and dancer particularly.
Well, so, I mean, people love Chorus Line, but some people absolutely hate it.
I know.
So it's weird how like people come from it from two different vantage points. They think of it as, you know, kind of corny and sappy, right?
They do sometimes. I like to think that that's the minority speaking, but yeah, I think some people think it's a little heavy-handed, but I'm certainly on the side of thinking it's really effective. And you know, when you see the show, you end up rooting for these people regardless of whether you're an actor or not.
Now, who did you play when you were in Chorus Line?
I played Don. So he's kind of a conglomeration of a few different people's stories from the night they all taped. The dancers sat around and taped the stories with Michael Bennett. He's a few different people's stories put together to play kind of the archetypal straight male dancer.
And what was his song?
Yeah, he has a solo in the montage right after Morales sings. And he sings about the nightclub union. You know, he like, you know, kind of dancing and perhaps stripping, depending on how you interpret it, at the nightclub when he's a teen. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So you were really typecast because he's the only heterosexual character in the whole show.
Well, Zach, you know, Zach, the director, kind of narrator voice, omniscient voice sometimes, depending on how it's directed, is also straight. The one who has a bit of a romance with Cassie.
So it was the mid 70s in New York, and a lot of actors, singer, dancers, and models were out of work. And they got together and they said, you know, let's put together our own theater company, our own conservatory, so we can have some jobs. And Michael Bennett, along with Donna McKechnie, and she, Michael Bennett is the turkey lurkey guy.
It's turkey lurkey time. Tom Turkey ran away, but he just came home.
Turkey lurkey time guy.
He choreographed a lot of stuff.
But like today, people know him for that.
Turkey, yeah.
And the woman who's dancing, flinging her arms, that's Donna McKechnie, who sings Music in the Mirror. And so they showed up to this audition, basically it was kind of like an audition slash workshop with a tape recorder. And they just started asking all the performers to bare their souls.
They did. Yeah. A lot of the dancers involved didn't really know what the plan was, but they knew Michael Bennett of Promises, Promises fame and all his other projects. So they kind of, they showed up and essentially started doing a dance class. And then later in the evening, they all sat around 1974. I think it was January 26th, actually. And they sat around and did exactly that. And
I guess the rest is history.
Right.
Well, Sammy Williams, the dancer who talked about being gay, fitting into his sister's tap dancing shoes by wearing extra socks, they turned that into the tap dancing song that Wayne Emilio later performs, I Can Do That.
I could do that. I could do that. One morning, sis won't go to dance class. I grab her shoes and tights and all, but my foot's too small, so I stuff her shoes with extra socks. Run 7 blocks in nothing flat. Hell, I can do that. I can do that.
And then so in interviewing a lot of the people who are involved in it, they said that because Sammy Williams was so brave in coming out of the closet and talking about playing sports and also tap dancing and being bullied and being gay and managing all those things, that's why all the other actors and dancers could come out of their own closets and tell their own stories.
And what's interesting about that, too, is that when you see the show, he actually isn't one of the gay stories at the forefront. He comes out and he does his song and talks about sneaking his tap shoes in and doing that whole number. But his being gay is actually not a huge part of that story. When they were building the show, they ended up putting the focus on, obviously, Paul's story is the heart of the show. And that takes some focus. And there are some more fun, flamboyant characters, Bobby and Greg, others in the show, who kind of fill that void. But yes, that character was gay and kind of got the whole ball rolling.
But of all the songs in the musical, the one that everybody remembers is Tits and Ass.
Absolutely.
Tits and Ass, where the cupboard once was bare. Now you knock and someone's there. You have got them, hey, top to bottom, hey. It's a guess, just a dash of silicone. Shake your new maracas and you're fine. Tits and Ass can change your life.
Is that the song that resonates with you?
Not exactly. I grew up doing sports and kind of finding dance in high school and stuff. So I'm definitely more of an I can do that kind of story. But
I can do him. I can do
them. Right, you know, exactly.
You know, it's funny when you watch the movie, of course, I'm with, is it Audrey Landers who sings Tits and Ass? You're just like, she's so flat-chested. It was like, what did she have before? Were they like holes?
Right, I know. A lot of people end up really playing into it. I know people end up wearing big padded bras and all kinds of stuff for the show to pull off the look.
Back when I was still in the closet, I dated a girl, and that was her role in A Chorus Line. She sang Tits and Ass. And she did have tits, and she did have ass.
And a lot more than that, too. She had plenty of everything. John, in terms of like your journey to being a Broadway performer, I mean, you're a musical theater performer mostly, right?
Yes, that's where work has taken me, yeah.
And is that how, like, you started out, or were you going into your sister's tap dancing shoes, or?
No, I have one younger brother, and he definitely doesn't dance, so I wasn't stealing his shoes, maybe his soccer cleats, but no, I started off singing. I always grew up singing, and when I was in elementary school and middle school, I was kind of doing the talent show circuit around Chattanooga and Tennessee. And
what is the talent show? So you're a kid doing a talent show thing?
Yes.
What is that like? And is it like church basements and stuff?
Sometimes. Yeah, I definitely sang in church. I was definitely the youngest member of the church choir. There was a youth choir, but I only did that for about a year, and then they let me sing with the adult choir, and I sat between two very shiny bald-headed men, and I had a lot of long blonde hair. It was very funny. But yeah, I started doing that, and then the, you know, different things like music festivals. I remember I sang in the mall a few times for competitions and all kinds of silly stuff. I had a good like 2-year run of singing the national anthem absolutely everywhere I could. It was fun.
Oh, so you were like the kid that they would drag out to sports events and be like, right, we have John Marshall Jr. singing the national anthem.
Exactly. Definitely at all my swim meets. I swam for 10 years, so I definitely sang it at a ton of swim meets, my brother's soccer games, my soccer games, all kinds of stuff. So that's how it started, singing. And then I had the option of going to either a performing arts high school or another school, kind of to focus more in sports. And still to this day, it's kind of a mystery how I ended up convincing my parents to let me kind of go to the arts school. But I did. And that's where you had to declare a major, and I was a vocal major, and I took an elective musical theater class. This is all in ninth grade, my freshman year of high school. And then I kind of fell in love with musical theater and learned that in order to be in a musical, which I did, my first one was Thoroughly Modern Millie, I had to learn to dance, and it kind of filled that athletic void for me. And then I started doing more and more musicals and taking more and more dance class, and, you know, cut to 15 years later, and here we are.
There's this really hot guy who works out at our gym. His name is Paul LaRosa. You can search for him on the blog that drools over sexy opera singers called Barahunks.
Okay.
And he is quoted as saying that the most athletic thing he does besides playing professional soccer is being a professional opera singer, that it's more physically demanding on him than any kind of sports.
I can certainly believe that. And especially the technique that you learn when you're opera, you know, training in opera, especially, you're accessing every cavern of your body to produce maximum sound in it, you know, and right.
Deep,
you know, exactly.
Deep, baby.
Exactly. Exactly. But, yeah. And it's really physically engaging to sing that way, the correct way.
And,
yeah.
You know, in terms of your like training, you've done pretty much everything there is. I mean, you studied tap, modern, jazz, ballet, Lamaze.
Lamaze was my personal favorite, for sure.
Buto. Have you studied Buto, Japanese Buto dance? Do you know what that is?
I do, actually, but no, I have not. I have not studied it. No.
That's when you move, for the listeners out there, that's when you move really slowly.
Really slow. No, I've definitely done some, you know, some, I had an Asian theater class and, you know, I have some kabuki training, but that's the extent for me. Yeah.
Were you involved in the Chicago Shakespeare Theater production when they brought in the Japanese performers to do Macbeth?
No, I was not. I did Peter Pan at Chicago Shakespeare.
Okay.
And that's the one show I've done there.
Yeah, you've done just about everything there is. Like, you know, like I was looking at your resume and it's just like, you're kind of just like a who's who list of like performances and musical theater. What is like, you know, really kind of influenced you as a person, as a performer the most?
Oh, wow. Well, I think it's a few things. I mean, I have to credit a dance teacher I had in high school, Jessica LaLiberty Bowman. And she's kind of who introduced me to dance and kind of loving theater and art more fully. And then other than that, I still love singing. There are a lot of singers who I look up to, and there are a lot of kind of song and dance men that I look up to as well, like the you know, the Gene Kellys and the Danny Kays and folks like that too.
Do you have any like, you know, showbiz crushes that you're like either want to be with or be them, you know, or both?
There's a dancer, I just respect all the dancing he's done, and you can tell, and he's in the back pocket of a lot of people because he shows up on tons of award shows and things like that. But his name's Charlie Williams and he's super hot and super gorgeous.
I know
gorgeous.
Charlie Williams. I was and obsessed with him because he was in the Cher musical.
Yes, he was. So
yeah, I ran into him at a Sidetrack and I was like, you are a legend. Even though I was like, oh, he's looking at me.
he's smoking hot, but he's an incredible dancer, and I really appreciate how grounded and masculine he is when he moves. That's what I'm into.
And it's not easy doing that when you're dancing in a Cher musical.
Exactly, and you know what? He can sure pull it off. So I'm a huge fan. Yeah.
Now we were talking earlier, and you said for Chorus Line, which Foster was absolutely obsessed with, and he's like, when he watched this as a teenager, he was like, "Oh my god, I could never be at Broadway because they teach you these choreography, like, and you have to pick it up right away." But you were saying that's not even the case anymore. That when you come into audition for Chorus Line, you have to have the choreography down already. How are you even supposed to learn it?
Well, it depends. With something like a Chorus Line, if you're auditioning for a production and you know that they're restaging it or doing the original choreo at least, same with West Side Story, you kind of go in and you know it just for your benefit so you can go nail it. And if you're trained, which you need to be in those shows, there is a lot of technique involved. You do kind of obtain the ability to watch a video and teach yourself. Teach yourself the choreography pretty easily.
So you're expected to like go on YouTube or something, and they'll send you and be like, know this by the time you show up, or how does that work?
Well, I mean, I learned it in dance classes in college, and there's certain choreography that a lot of teachers just teach in class because it's part of kind of the iconic rep that you should know in a Chorus Line. The opening audition sequence of a Chorus Line, everyone should learn.
What kind of classes have you had?
Well, in high school, I started in jazz and musical theater training, and then I ended up doing some more tap and modern. And I actually didn't take a ballet class until I went to college. I've taken about everything.
The show's called Feast of Fun. It's not called classes. Next question.
Have you ever had an audition like they do in Showgirls?
Like they do in Showgirls? What do you mean by that?
Well, it's like, you know, you have to be topless and he's wondering why your tits aren't hard.
No, but well maybe not that way, because obviously that movie's ridiculous. Yeah. But in a sense, like, have you ever had an audition where the director or the person who's holding the audition crosses the line into sexual harassment?
I won't say what show it was for, but I was in an audition once where it was my first year out of school, and in the audition they asked me to take my shirt off, which I was like, okay, this guy would be shirtless in the role. It was kind of like a sexual role, so I was like, okay, got it. That was fine, even though that probably shouldn't have even happened either. And then I got the call back, and in the call back, they were like, the director is planning to do have full nudity in the show. So in your call back, be prepared to do that.
Wow.
And and I remember being in the call back, and this stage, man, just like sweet young girl. And this is not that long ago. This is like 5 years ago, and this could never happen now.
Yeah.
With the Me Too movement. Is that what right?
No. I just mean like asking someone to do this at all. It would be inappropriate. And but the room was full. There were probably like five people behind the table, and they're like, "Oh," they said, "Okay, and now if you would like to drop your pants," and basically, it just felt like they wanted to see your dick, and it was absolutely miserable. And I did it, and I think when I look back on that, I'm like, "What was I thinking?" And I didn't even get the role.
You should have worn a cock ring.
I guess so. But
so did they basically cast the person based on what their penis looked like?
No, I certainly hope not. They definitely knew that show was going to have full frontal in it. And they were saying they wanted to make sure that the actor was comfortable with full frontal. That's why they were asking for it in the audition.
So maybe like crying when you took your clothes off probably wasn't a good idea. You were like, I want to show emotion.
No, it was terrible. It felt like...
I'm so sorry.
No, I wasn't actually traumatized in the moment. It was just very strange. It felt like, you know, in middle school when you're like changing in the locker room with the boys for the first time, you're like... Okay, you're like, deep breath, I'm going to drop my pants, and we're just doing this, and here we go.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's terrifying. When I was a little kid, my mother was on the board of directors for the ballet company in my hometown, and they were going to take some photos. And my mom said, you're going to be in the photo, even though I didn't take ballet. And she said, don't worry, it's just from the waist down. And my older brother, who's 2 years older than me, told me, he's like, yeah, it's going to be in the nude. And I was just like, and so I'm sitting there waiting for hours for this photographer to show up. And I'm thinking, God, I'm going to be naked in the nude. And I was just like, I was absolutely mortified. Well, the photographer never ended, like he didn't end up showing up or something like that. So we just all went home, and I was just like, oh, thank God. And it wasn't until like years later that I was just like, I'm pretty sure my brother was probably lying to me. Because I was only like 5 or 6 at the time.
Why do you think your brother said that to you?
He was just, you know, just being a weirdo.
I would have said, I would have tormented my younger brother in the same way.
Oh my God.
I would have. It's terrible, but I would have.
Again, step, kick, kick, leap, kick, touch. That connects with turn, turn, out, in, touch. Step, step, kick, kick, leap, kick, touch. Got it? Going on. And turn, turn, touch, down, back step, pivot step. Walk, 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 right. Let's do the whole combination facing away from the mirror. From the top. A 5, 6, 7, 8.
Well, if you're auditioning for a chorus line and you're required to know the choreography, and I know that the movie has different choreography than like what you can see Broadway productions on YouTube, which is the right one to learn? The Michael Douglas version or the Michael Bennett?
that's definitely the Michael Bennett.
Yeah.
That opening sequence is what they're going to have you do. And often they won't have you do like the original ballet across the floor sequence, but that 5, 6, 7, 8, like, yeah, everyone's gotta know that. And they do teach it. They don't just like throw you immediately, put you in groups of four and make you do it memorized. They do do it. They do walk you through the moves like a normal dance call, but it moves pretty quick. And you don't want to be the person who's learning it for the first time, because everyone else around you will have known it for years.
So the choreographer says, step, kick, kick, leap, kick, touch again.
Yes.
That connects with turn, turn, out, touch, step, step, kick, kick, leap, kick, touch. Got it? Going on, turn, touch, down, back, step, pivot, step, walk, 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 sachet, chante, and throw some attitude.
Yes. Oh my gosh. My neck is sore just hearing that.
Is there actual choreography that aligns with those words?
Yes, absolutely. The step, kick, kicks are choreographed and set for sure.
So like, cause I'm looking here and he's saying step, kick, kick, leap, kick, touch. What are you touching?
Touch your, so when you kick
your
leg in the air, when it comes down, instead of like putting all your weight on it, you're bringing that leg down out of the air and just touching it on the ground.
Okay. And then, that connects with,
I was just trying to learn the choreography. I think at the tender age of,
Oh, stop it. I just think it's funny, like, because I don't know what the choreography.
Really needs this job.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, in my mind, I'm imagining, like, what the choreography must be like, and it just sounds bonkers, you know? Like, he's just screaming words at them.
Touchdown, back step, pivot step, walk, walk, walk.
When quarantine's over, we'll get together and we'll do a class.
Oh, that would be so much fun. I hope I get this job.
Oh, it's so fun. It'll bring you to life again.
Have you ever been in a situation where you really wanted to get the audition and you're like, thought you had it and they didn't choose you?
Yes. There are a couple roles
that
I felt that way for. Honestly, the shows that I really, that I was really dying to be in the ensemble in, the Chorus Lines, the West Side Stories, the big dance shows. I got most of those that I wanted.
Because you really needed this job.
I really needed it. And there's also something too that happens, I think, physically in dance. When you want it, you dance a little harder and your mind is a little sharper. And I think you can execute the choreography better if there's some extra hunger there. Not anxiety that cripples you, but like some extra want. So I, dance wise, I feel like I get those, but there have been a couple roles like, and I'm sad about this one too, because I think I may have just finally aged out of it, but,
yeah, Frankie, you're a little too old to play Pippin.
Well, Frankie Epps and Parade.
Okay.
I really, really wanted that. And I got down to the last two or three guys in a production here in town for that. And I thought I nailed it. I mean, I just went in and I sang and acted the shit out of it. And, I thought I really nailed it, but there was the guy they ended up going with looked even younger than me at the time. And I was like, damn it.
Would you ever consider like cross dressing to play Annie?
if that was an option, absolutely.
Have they ever had a boy Annie? They've had boys play the orphans, right?
Yeah, they always.
Absolutely. You know what? I'm sure, absolutely sure there must be one somewhere. I feel like there's a kind of a fun recording floating around of some little boy who did it and was great, but now I can't remember. It should be a little girl. Let's not take female roles away from women.
More roles away from women. So
right, exactly. But there's some like Broadway bound little boy whose voice hadn't changed yet who sang the shit out of Annie.
did you ever swipe your audition scorecard and saw that you got Dance 10, Looks 3, or even worse?
Thankfully, I don't think there are like dance cards anymore. Often the choreographer will kind of arrange your resumes out in the order in that you're dancing and take notes on your resume and stuff. But it would be a pretty, I want to know the details of that, of that story, because how in the world did she swipe her dance card? You know what I mean? That would be a pretty bold move to walk up to the table and snatch it out of the pile.
Well, and she was not good looking at the time she stole her dance card. So she had to do other things to try to distract them.
Right. Exactly.
What did you do? And this is all based on true stories.
That's
the thing. So, like, I heard that the at the ballet song where the girls are singing about how her father married her mother because he felt sorry for her, and it was like the last chance, and that the mother found the father's mistress's earrings in the car.
Life with my dad wasn't ever a picnic, more like a come as you are. When I was 5, I remember my mother dug earrings out of the car. I knew that they weren't hers, but it wasn't something you'd want to discuss. He wasn't warm. Well, not to her. Well, not to us. That everyone is beautiful at the ballet.
That actually was based on a real story, and the dancers were mortified singing that in front of their parents in the audience.
Right. Oh, I bet. I bet. I guess you could deny, right? But
you're like, well, somebody else's
parents.
That was
somebody else, yeah.
And the mother's like, that's oddly specific, the earrings.
Yeah. It's just the one made-up story in the whole show. Don't worry about it, Mom.
Yeah, and then the guy's like, I have a boner.
Right.
Yeah, it's amazing that of all these kind of experimental Broadway musicals that it still stands up to the test of time and that people turn to it and listen to it. And I think part of it is that it really speaks to this, like, the human experience of desire. And especially, I think, in this past year when we've just been so bottled in and out of work and putting our lives on pause because, of failed leadership, and we're just, waiting for society and the world to continue rotating and moving on so we can move on with our lives. How's this year been for you?
You know, this year has been okay. I've been talking with a lot of my artist friends, and in a way, at this point, we're all really ready to get back to it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people I talked to, the first 6 months was a really nice chance to give yourself a break from the hustle, And especially with arts folks, there's this pressure to always have 8 projects going on, even if some of them are bullshit. And you know what I mean? And,
oh, I know. I know lots of art people with lots of bullshit projects.
Yeah, and it's like...
Guilty.
Well, and people just like wanting to stay busy so they don't lose their minds and have something to say when you see your friend at the grocery store and they ask you what you're doing, and people feel so pressured to talk about their work. Like, no other profession does that. Like, my dad, who's in sales for a medical company... If his friend asks him how he's doing, he doesn't like talk about how his sales week was. Mm. But artists feel pressure to be like, oh, well, I've got this going on. I just had a great callback and I booked this and I'm doing this show right now and I have another one lined up. And there's this pressure and anxiety to prove your worth as a successful artist. And for that to be able to go away for 6 months, a year, is honestly, I've seen some people who I thought were really uptight suddenly become very cool, relaxed people because that pressure is gone and we talk about real things and not the next thing that's on the agenda and what they did today to progress their career and blah, blah, blah.
Well, President Joe Biden has already been sworn in and is our president. Mm-hmm. And Kamala Harris is the first woman to be a vice president and first woman of color.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. First Jamaican.
And she's
black.
She's going to make America responsible for those shit.
First Indian.
For, yeah. And she knows how to, and the first person who knows how to cook.
And I just love that they put her on the cover of Vogue, like even just before she becomes the vice president.
Yeah.
Because it's a real F you to Melania, because Trump and Melania were very disappointed that she never got on any of the covers of the fashion magazines. Like, she's the most stylish first lady. Why isn't she on the cover? Well, because you're terrible people is why.
Well, wasn't she on the cover of Hustler magazine? So doesn't that count?
Was the back page, I think.
Right, the back page, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, boy, it's nice to be able to breathe a sigh of relief, you know.
A new world, right?
Yeah.
We're ready. I think we're all very ready.
Mm-hmm. We're ready to dance in front of the music.
I just watched Kill Bill the other day, volumes 1 and 2, and I was just like, it felt really appropriate because it was like, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen Kill Bill, but she goes into a coma for 4 years, basically. And then wakes up and she's just like, it's time for revenge. And I found it very inspiring, you know.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are waking up from the coma right now, mm-hmm. right?
What's also interesting that today is Dolly Parton's birthday. And I didn't realize how many of our friends have selfies with Dolly Parton through the years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I believe it.
Like, I'm like, am I the only person who hasn't met Dolly Parton per person? It's like, I was just like,
well, you know, you have to show up, like, if she's doing a book signing or she's doing something, or you pay for a meet and greet, and there you are, right? Yeah.
The closest I've ever come, I was in Dollywood with my parents, with my grandparents as maybe a 9-year-old. Mm-hmm. We used to do, like, summer vacations with my grandparents there. And she was at the park, and that's, I never saw her. I never knew anything, but she was at the park and everyone was all a flutter.
We saw her at the opening of 9 to 5 here in Chicago at the, when they did the musical that she wrote. And then also, she, it was her birthday then too, wasn't it? Did she
it
come
was,
out? And they cut a piece of cake. They had a cake for her and she came out on stage and cut the cake. Did they give us a slice of that cake? I don't think they did.
I don't think Dolly ate it either. She's a part vampire.
Oh my
so she
gosh.
Can't
she's
eat
so
in front of
like, I mean, she's all boobs, but like she looks tiny and very thin and svelte. I'm sure she's super fit and works out all the time. And then we also saw her at Ravinia once, but that was kind of, you know, from a distance. So you're from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Indeed.
The home of Lady Bunny and Leslie Jordan.
And Usher.
And Usher.
And Samuel L. Jackson went to my high school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
But why I think it's really interesting, and for the listeners, if you can imagine traveling back in time before bitterness and exhaustion and adversity, you know, weathered down Lady Bunny and Leslie Jordan, I feel like I'm talking to you is like this young, you know, them at their beginning of their lives and their careers. And I know you're familiar with both of them as entertainers. Like, does it make you worry a little bit? You're like,
what's to become of me when I become ancient?
You know, I mean, if I can pull off some of the stuff that Leslie Jordan's still doing, I'll happily follow in his footsteps. But I think we're just different enough, but he is hilarious. My first job in Chattanooga was at this place called the Bluffview Art District. It has a little cafe, a couple restaurants, and I had kind of worked my way up, and I was working Thanksgiving Day at this restaurant. I was the server. I was 16 years old, and I was going to work this kind of, you know, special Thanksgiving brunch and then go home and do Thanksgiving with my family. And I took care of Leslie Jordan and his twin sisters. And he was
He has twin sisters?
Yes.
He's a triplet?
No. I think his sisters are twins.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And they are, if you can imagine, three Leslie Jordans all hanging out together and having Thanksgiving brunch. That's what it was like. And he was an absolute, just a relentless flirt, but very funny. And
can you imitate him trying to pick you up?
He said something very funny to me. He was like, thank you so much for working today. Well, actually, what'd he say? He was like, I was going to say I feel so bad for you for working on Thanksgiving, but I don't actually because I didn't want to cook.
That's pretty funny. Well, Lady Buddy worked in a restaurant with Leslie Jordan. He was a server, and she was the bus person. So imagine teenage Lady Bunny working with a younger Leslie Jordan in a restaurant. That must have been some wild times.
I can only imagine. Yeah.
Well, we don't really need to imagine it. We're talking. I mean, I feel like we're caught in some time loop here. Because normally we talk to Lady Bunny at, you know.
Well, how tall are you, though?
I'm 5'6".
Okay, that's probably Leslie Jordan area. Yeah. What's he like? 5'2"?
Yeah,
he's a little guy. Yeah, he's a pocket little. Guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's Bunny's height? She's about like 5'10", right?
I'd say yeah. She's at least 5'10". Yeah.
Girl, fag. But like in terms of like, you know, them as personalities, you know, I imagine that sort of like affects everybody who's gay in Chattanooga. They're all like, well, this is the hometown of Leslie Jordan and Lady Bunny.
I wonder if people feel that way. I certainly did not, because growing up there, you would not have. I think maybe it's different now, but I definitely was more conservative, and I was not as out and proud and bold as he certainly is now.
So for you, like coming out as gay took place more as an adult in the middle of your entertainment career, not when you were in your high school or college years.
No, not at all. I started coming out in high school, but only at school. I went to an art school. It was very liberal. It was kind of a little safe haven for me. Mm-hmm. So I came out to a lot of my friends and people my age. I was kind of safe around and was out with them. And then my mom kind of picked it up, and I came out to my brother all then. But it took my dad a while to come around. And I went away to college and, you know, sent my family a bunch of letters and came out, and they all wrote back with, you know, various mostly supportive responses. And it just took some time. And I basically went away to college, came back as an adult. And I think it was one of those, like, they realized that if they wanted me in their life, it was kind of a take me or leave me situation. It wasn't high stakes, but luckily I was welcomed back pretty openly, which is good.
What's the thing? It's like, it's kind of like Donna McKechnie and Music in the Mirror. You're like, let me dance for you. It's like young queer people are like, let me love you to their families. Right. And their families are like, I'm not sure. You know, mm-hmm. they're hesitant because part of it is, I think it's something that they're not familiar with. And so in a lot of ways, coming out is a process of educating our families.
Well, my mom has a memory that I don't even remember, but my dad with his best friends, his fraternity brothers, they own a farm in Alabama, and they go down there and hunt on that. So we would all go down there and like spend hunting weekends down there together. And I was like by the fire with my mom, like some bonfire, and I was sitting with my mom one day, and apparently I was little and told her I was gay. And I have no recollection of this. And but she, a few years ago, told me that story. And because my memory is that I never even knew that gay was like an acceptable, like I didn't know what it was other than a slur until basically high school.
And so your mother's like,
okay, dear.
Nothing. He said nothing.
Yeah. And she said that she said to me, just don't tell your dad right now. Let me handle it. But I have no recollection of this interaction at all. But apparently I did that when I was pretty young.
Well, thank goodness that we have the wisdom, you know, parents with wisdom that didn't put us in like, you know, torture or gay conversion therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know?
No doubt.
Right.
Gay conversion torture.
I was watching my friends. I was at my friend's house, and her little kid was watching The Simpsons with another one of their friends. There was a couple of twins over, and the Simpsons mentioned something about gay, and one of the twins goes, "I'm gay," and the little boy goes, "I'm gay too." And I looked at them, I'm like, "I'm gay too," and I just kind of like kept walking out of the room because, you know, I wasn't even really sure like if they knew what that meant. But part of me kind of was just like, maybe they do, because my friend said that, you know, when little kids start swearing and using cuss words, they never use them incorrectly. They always use them the right way. When they were like, when they call somebody an asshole, it's like, because that person's being an asshole. Mm-hmm. You know? So it's not like they misunderstand what these words mean.
That's funny, because that's kind of what I'm saying too. Like, there was something in you that knew you were gay even when you were little, though you had not fully even realized that with yourself. And that's exactly how I was.
Mm. Yeah. In terms of, you know, like musical theater and performances, do you feel like taking on these kind of roles helped you to be more confident in your authentic self? Or do you feel like, you know, because actors are always expected to be somebody else, that you start sort of like losing your own identity because you get so into the role you're playing?
Do the roles that I've done in general, have they helped me evolve, or doing gay roles?
Well, both. You know, I know you've played some gay roles in your career too, you know, where you're like, this feels pretty good. I think I'll do this all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my first kind of like big step out in a supporting role was as a gay character, and it was the most freeing experience ever. It was like, he was a song and dance man, which is what I want to do. And this guy was gay, and he was confidently gay, and he helps bring this other guy out of the closet. And it was an absolute ball to do. And by doing that role, it gave me permission to be bolder in all of my choices and not. And what's funny, I don't think I was particularly flamboyant in the role at all, actually, but I gave myself permission not to put my like straight actor filter on what I was doing. And it really freed me up. And it's so funny because even straight men, you can walk, particularly in theater, not as much on film. You'll hear it in their voices on film, but on stage, even confident straight men off stage, you see them step on stage and they put this strange, like puffed up artificial, "I am a leading man now" thing on.
Yeah. We did a podcast about this phenomena that actors, you know, because there's such a welcoming environment in most theater programs in high schools and colleges where a lot of people are openly gay, and a lot of queer people, LGBTQ people, are attracted to be in theater programs because they can flourish, right? And as a consequence, a lot of cisgendered heterosexual people start picking up gay affectations in their speech. And when they go to Los Angeles to start auditioning for roles, the first thing that they're told is like, "You sound too gay. You need to butch it up." And so you have actors like Jason Eccles, like in Supernatural, who I don't think like in real life he actually sounds that way, but you know, he just sounds like he's
machine fire.
You know, he's a machine gun fire. You know,
they all growl, and yeah, it's.
They don't teach that in a school, darling.
They don't. And they teach quite the opposite of it as far as vocal technique, because it's unhealthy to speak that way.
So in terms of, you know, butching it up, I guess, do you have your own butch voice that you use?
I mean, I'm kind of lucky because I don't.
Yeah.
I don't speak especially high, but.
Because I could see you easily getting into Leslie Jordan territory.
Oh, for sure. And
girl.
Exactly. Two glasses of wine, I'm there. For me, it's less about, I don't think about it as butching it up as much as far as like just rounding out the sound, and there's more of like an open stage like performance sound that I'll try and speak with. And if there's a dialect, I'll try and lean into that. But yeah, I think the idea of butching it up is really not specific and it's not helpful. You need to think about what your character needs from you and focus on that and how that informs the way you speak, and it will come that way. But to hear butch it up or sound straighter or whatever is a really horrible direction and totally vague and not helpful from a director or whoever might give that note.
So make what would be care- like a more constructive way if, you know, if you're having like the producers and they're wanting you to, you know, because everybody's like, well, sissy that up. That's very clear, right? It's like if you're playing Hitler and the producers, you need to sissy it up.
Right, right, right.
But if you're, you know, trying to do a Jason Eccles supernatural voice, what direction would you give somebody?
Well, I think it's like give them more specific character driven questions. Mm-hmm. Where are they from? Why do they guide them towards a sound that you want versus just telling them to butch it up. So yeah, be like, where are they from? And you can give an actor this information, be like, I think if he's from this place and his dad might sound like this, maybe you sound more like your father who speaks like this. And that is helpful to an actor and justify,
I like that. Sound like and, your and dad. Like,
right. And justifiable to a character and not like your actual dad, just all within the world of the play. So you're talking about the character, and there's so much room for a director or a vocal coach or a dialect coach, whoever's giving the note to help with the direction from a character standpoint and guide them in the way that you want there without saying butch it up, which frankly is, I don't know. I hope most people wouldn't say that anymore. Yeah.
One of the main point of a chorus line and the way the show ends is that once we've sort of fallen in love with all these characters, and certainly we fall in love with you, John Marshall Jr., is that they disappear back into this, you know, chorus line of golden tuxedos.
Right.
That the greatest performers' names never get known or are soon forgotten. And that by being good as a actor, singer, or dancer, you don't get to stand out. You become one of the crowd. For you, like, is that something that you sort of, you know, to some degree, like, we get into show business because we're seeking attention to you know, let's not deny that. But, you know, once you're in show business and arts and entertainment, you realize that, you know, so much of this is to give and not to receive and to lose yourself for the greater good of the project.
Without a doubt. And I think that's something you have to come to terms with you and your own ego, you know, as far as like, I think that's a big professional step that you take. I think most people learn it quickly within the first few years. And especially if you're an ensemble member, you learn that it is a job sometimes, you know, and it's like you go to work and you do your role, you know, and you count your blessings that it's dancing and doing what you love versus, I don't know, whatever your job is that you would never want to do, you know? And I think you just have to kind of level with yourself and not think that you're fading to the background. You're still doing what you love, even if you're not in the spotlight, because you move in and out of the spotlight when you're doing projects. I mean, I guess a lot of people, you know, not a lot of people, some people become super famous and they go from role to role to role to role to role. But a lot of theater folks, you know, successful theater folks that you never know about, you've never heard of them, have made long-lasting careers by moving between working in the ensemble, supporting roles, lead roles, understudying, and you do that for your whole life. Iris Lieberman is an actor in town who's in her 60s, and she's someone I've always looked up to, and she is a Chicago actor through and through. And she's done some national tours and stuff, but she has worked nonstop forever, and it's because she takes the work and does the work, and there's not ego about it. And she goes to auditions. She's not sitting at home waiting for a call. She does the work, and she loves it. And that's what you have to do.
Yeah. Who was it that said the job of an actor is to audition? That was
Terry Garr.
Terry Garr. She had a she put out her biography called "Does This Wheelchair Make Me Look Fat?" she talks about
it was called Speed Bumps.
Speed Bumps.
And then she was going to call it "Does This Wheelchair Make Me Look Fat?" But she got a lot of
negative feedback. From the publisher. But in it, you know, she talks about her really unusual career in Hollywood, and you know, I mean, she's been in everything. She's an Academy Award-winning actor, and at the same time, you know, she says eventually, you know, all these names will be forgotten. You think about like actors or performers, you know, 100 years ago, we don't know any of their names.
No, you know, very few.
And part of it is even like, you know, with film or television, I kind of describe it as a form of like artificial intelligence. Like the people who did the Three Stooges live in those movies, but they never made, you know, the Howard brothers never made any money off of it. And they lived in relative modest lives where they struggled.
Well, same people with like Gilligan's Island, they didn't get really any residuals from those TV series, right?
Yeah, and so they almost kind of they describe it as kind of almost a resentfulness when knowing that their identities and their lives continue on indefinitely after they're long gone.
Well, I think it's particularly hard for people in that situation where it's like your whole career and your fame is based on a role. And if you got screwed over contractually and you're not reaping the benefits of that for a long time, that is really tough. That's really tough.
And then there's the other flip side of that is, you know, people who get a lot of attention, a lot of money, and they're overwhelmed by the process. And, you know, they don't know how to manage it. And you hear like, you know, even the British monarchy are just like, we're moving to Canada. Mm-hmm. What is it? The Harry and Meghan Markle.
Well, they live in what do you call it? In California.
Yeah, they moved to LA. Yeah. And in the middle of a pandemic, which wasn't the best move for them. But, you know,
it just kind of goes back to that. The hustle is exhausting. You know, and whether you're monarchs and that hustle is exhausting, or you're a regional theater actor, the hustle is exhausting. And that's why people quit, because, you know, it goes back to this idea that everyone, what the American dream is, you know, house, white picket fence and a steady 9-to-5 job. And like the idea of always looking for a job for the rest of your life is really exhausting, because even people who are really great at their jobs that are not in the arts, they have the job and like they can have an off day, but they're still going in, they're clocking in, they're collecting their salary. And sometimes you can afford to go through the motions, and because that security is there, and you never get to fully relax when you're an artist, because it is, I hate to use the word hustle, because I feel like that is loaded with anxiety, because I don't feel it that way. I feel pretty at ease and calm, and what happens is meant to happen. And I think a lot of people find that peace, but there is always a little bit of underlying no job security built in there, and the pressure to keep finding jobs. And that's why a lot of people quit, because it's exhausting. Yeah.
Well, as Betty Davis says, you have to like the work.
You have to like the work enough. Yeah.
And so how do you recharge your batteries? Like, what do you do outside of, I mean, right now you've sort of been this past year, you know, meditating, having good sex, hopefully, and working out and eating good food and watching TV shows and movies and, you know, trying to keep yourself financially above water.
Mm-hmm.
What do you normally do to recharge your batteries so you don't quit?
Well, I mean, I'm a yoga person. I really love yoga, and I recharge that way. But honestly, you know, I can't remember if anyone of note said this, but a lot of artists recommend that artists have an art that isn't their job, that is their outlet, you know? And for me, even though I sing for a living off, that's part of what I do professionally for sure. I love to sing. And even if I'm just like tinkering around on the piano and making up songs that will go nowhere and just singing for my own heart, that is a huge recharge for me. I sing all the time, but yes, I love to cook. So to your point, good food, good sex, good, you know, keeping your body and, you know, movable is all important stuff, but it's pretty basic for me. Yoga, cooking, singing, wine. That's nice too.
What kind of wine did you have?
It depends. I've become a red wine person. I never was because, you know,
stains your teeth.
It does. And I also am very weird about things that turn my mouth a color. Like I don't eat Oreos because they make your teeth black. And
We made homemade Oreos. They were so good.
They were so delicious. That's great. I don't think I've ever even heard of a homemade Oreo. That's great.
It is weird because you see these cookies, they're almost ubiquitous. But they are based on a recipe that people used to make in their homes, which is the Dutch process cocoa, which gets the cookies really dark like that, you know?
What are they? Is it still a super hard, crispy, crackery cookie?
It is. It's a good cookie. And then the inside, the cream stuff is really good because it's made with like fresh vanilla bean, so it's butter. Really delicious and buttercream.
Well, I can only imagine that the cream is a much better homemade. So I'm already I'm there.
I mean, part of me is like, you know, there's nothing wrong with just eating a whole sleeve of Oreo cookies.
Well,
that's why, you know, and what is it this past year, those right-wing Republican fascists were spreading on the internet saying that the Oreo, the Nabisco brand logo is satanic, which explains everything.
Because you eat it and you're like, the devil made me do it.
The devil made me do it. Right, right.
As Leslie Jordan would be like, the devil made you do it. I don't know if I'm imitating Leslie Jordan or Lady Bunny, but isn't
it's
the
same
thing,
isn't it?
Yeah. They're definitely, they feed off each other. They've got the same thing going on. Chattanooga accent?
Because I'm at, Tennessee is a big state. I imagine like people in different parts of Tennessee have a different kind of accent, right?
For sure. And it's funny. It's a more casual, like I love hearing my grandparents speak because it's a little more, not fully Scarlett O'Hara or anything, but it's a little
longer. That's Georgia, my dear.
Right. But it's a little longer. It's a little slower. It's a little more lovely, you know. I love all that. But no, the accent that like my mother speaks with, it's like everyone's got a lot to say. It's very quick, you know, it's a mile a minute. Everyone's got gossip. Very nice, bless her heart, but it's quick, you know.
Who does that remind me of? Richard Streetman.
Oh.
Who's also from Chattanooga, I believe.
No, he's from the Carolinas.
Carolina.
South Carolina,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. But that was like, that affectation, I was like, that's Richard Streetman there.
Yeah, he's he's a fast talker.
Yes. Well John.
No, go.
Oh, John, I just wanted to say it was really nice chatting with you about a chorus
auditioning and chorus line. Foster's absolutely obsessed with Chorus Line.
I'm so glad. I was so tickled to hear from you about wanting to take this a fully Chorus Line direction because, I mean, you know, it's like, it's the show. It's the actor passionate show. So I was thrilled to talk about it. Absolutely.
Well, I feel like we just scratched the surface. Like, I never got to ask you, have you ever had a acting teacher who bullied you like Morales had in Nothing?
I did. I had a teacher in college who just thought I was no good. And what's weird was I was like one of the,
Hey, listen, they don't have bobsleds in San Juan or Chattanooga.
That's what it was. I just needed a bobsled. I had one teacher who gave me a really hard time. I remember him giving notes in a rehearsal one time for we were doing Thoroughly Modern Millie, and he just actively like mocked the way I danced. And I am not a bad dancer, obviously. And, it was just very strange. And it was one of those moments, I thought I was losing my mind. I was like, surely this can't be as bad as it feels in the moment. And after the rehearsal, a lot of my friends who were in the show with me came up and they were like, that was totally uncalled for. I'm so sorry. But he told me to leave the program my sophomore year and told me this wasn't what I was supposed to do. A whole litany of things.
It does feel like a pyramid scheme, a lot of these acting schools.
Oh, without a doubt. Some of the most praised people in acting school have not done a single show post-graduating, you know.
Well, because they need all the people to produce these shows. And so the first semester people, they use them as kind of a, you know, the crew. Mm-hmm. But it's the seniors who get, you know, weeded out that they actually cast in a lot of the roles. And mm-hmm. it makes kind of sense, but they really do discourage people not to stay with the program because they just don't have enough roles for everybody to do.
I will say I was lucky because I knew that I was going to dance my way into some professional ensembles. And a lot of the time, I went to a very acting forward program. And a lot of the people who really thrive in those situations are singer actors. And it's harder. There just aren't as many ensembles that don't dance, you know, as there are ensembles that do dance. And so I made a lot of great connections. And my first jobs were just dancing up a storm in the ensemble. And that led to me being understudying a bunch of roles and then actually being seen and considered for more role. So it's harder when you feel like you're landing all these roles in college and then you graduate and you're a 22-year-old who's not actually going to play that role until you're 40, you know?
Nah. Is there a role that you would really like to do once this pandemic ends that you're like going to go for it?
I would love to be the brother in Ragtime. Do you know Ragtime?
Mm-mm. Well, actually, Terrence McNally wrote that.
Did he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He wrote the book.
I saw the movie when the movie came out, and I think the musical is based on the movie, right?
There's kind of a twist with the brother. He's just got a great story, and that's something that could be happening in Chicago whenever, you know, theater is happening more fully again. And I would love to do that. When I'm older, there are some great leading roles that I won't be able to do for a decade or more, honestly. But definitely all the song and dance man roles I'd like to do, the Danny K role in White Christmas, and I'd love to be what's his name, the guy in
Billy Elliot.
I couldn't dance young, and I wasn't a good dancer until I was older, so I would never have been Billy. Though, if I could go back,
go Billy.
If I could go back and take dance class instead of sports when I was 4, I absolutely would do it. But my parents just had no idea I would turn out this way.
They should have just given you your sister's tap dance shoes and a lot of extra socks.
I know.
Why can't you just buy me tap dancing shoes that fit me, Mom?
I remember a huge Christmas present I got in college was I got LaDuca. If you know what LaDuca is, the nicest brand of dance shoe, and they make a dance boot for men, but they're like $300. And
damn,
and I was Yeah, and I wanted them so bad, and my dad got them for me, and it was a bit, it was like such a huge full circle moment for my dad to buy me these really nice dance boots after him like taking me to my first dance class and that kind of, it was very fun.
I love my gay son.
I don't think he's walking in any pride, like the Chattanooga Pride Parade anytime soon, but he and I have come a long way, so we're good. Aww.
There are many ways to say I love you. And,
right.
And, you know, $300 dance shoes is a great way to do that.
It really was. It was nice.
Well, John, much love to you and your partner and your family and your acting and theater family as well. And I hope things, inspire you when, because, you know, it's just a matter of time before those auditions start coming up.
I know.
And I can't use you if you can't dance. I can't use you if you can't sell. I can't use you if you can't thrust it.
And I hope to see you in the neighborhood. You're just a block away.
This is such just an irony.
I know, right?
I know. Now that we're new neighbors, it'll be nice to kind of make an official connection when we can, you know, see each other, you know.
And not die.
And not die.
We'll have a little picnic in the park.
I'd love it. That's the hardest part about winter so far is no picnics. I've fully invested in all things picnic this summer.
You saw The Red Shoes? That was my favorite film as a child. It inspired me. It was like, no one knows what The Red Shoes is.
Kelly Bishop in the little like documentary that you had sent me just recently.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
She is so fantastic in it. Just, she is Sheila through and through, just like kind of over it, throwing shade the whole time. It's I'm like, well, this is the most perfect casting in the world.
So for people who don't know, Sheila is the haggard, the old dancer who's ready to quit. But she's still trying, and she's like, I don't want people to know my age. And she takes a lot of smoking breaks.
Right. And Kelly Bishop, who everyone knows as the mother on Gilmore Girls, you know?
So, oh, really? She was in Chorus Line.
Mm-hmm. She's the original Sheila, and then plays...
Get out of here.
You know, Lorelai's mother on Gilmore Girls.
She's not in the movie, though. She was in Broadway.
Correct. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. That movie was such a tragedy, you know?
It was.
Anybody who expects the, like, if you're just getting your feet wet with a Chorus Line, we recommend listening to the original Broadway soundtrack that is on Apple Music and, you know, Spotify and those services. Because the movie just is a train wreck. I think they should just try it again, you know, and the saddest thing is the Donna McKechnie song, The Music in the Mirror, is kind of broken apart and spoken in the movie. And
it is.
It's just a mess.
Well, the biggest, especially for Chorus Line lovers, if you have not seen Every Little Step, it is the best documentary maybe that I've ever seen, but particularly if you're a Chorus Line fan, because it's a documentary about them, about the casting and making of the revival. And it's absolutely spectacular. And especially if you haven't seen it, y'all should watch it. It'll blow your mind. We should have done a required viewing before we had this conversation.
Right, right. Well, we'll just have to do it again in person.
Yes, absolutely. But, I mean, of course, you know, we could go on and on.
Charles McGowan, the straight version of the I Can Do That guy,
mm-hmm.
He met his wife in the movie, Pam Klinger, who sings at the ballet.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, they didn't do much. They got married, had kids, and had a wonderful life.
Oh,
and then died of old age.
Yeah.
That's how old this movie is.
But it's not a bad way to go.
Michael Douglas, still alive, still going at it.
He still is, still acting. The dream, right?
That was one of his, he did that role of the director while he was doing like Romancing the Stone, like mm-hmm. as a quick little project. Cause he's just he recorded all his parts in like a day.
Really?
Yeah. He just sit there and like screaming at empty space.
That's like, amazing.
The scenes between the actors and Michael Douglas, as I understand from reading about it, weren't shot together. So,
right, yeah. Because you don't a lot of productions, you never see Zach. Most, I think, a lot of them now use the opportunity to bring Zach onto the stage to do that big dramatic scene with Cassie about, you know, are they in love? Are they not? Blah blah blah. Give me the job. I think originally it's written where he's never on stage. He's this omniscient presence in the back of the theater.
I'm sorry, John Marshall Jr. I can't cast you in the role. You're too good. I was like, that's a lie. You're just saying that to make me feel good.
Mm.
That is one of the best moments of doing the show, I'll admit, is every night when you're standing on the line and he calls out who makes it. And Don, my character, doesn't make the line.
Oh.
And gosh, it's just heartbreaking, but a thrill to act every night. Yeah.
So you, in a production of A Chorus Line, every single night you get rejected over and over again.
Every single time, yeah.
So you don't have to put on the gold tuxedo at the end and do that schmaltzy number.
No, everybody comes back for that.
Oh, they do?
Yeah.
So you don't get cast, but you do get cast.
Well, it's like you kind of, I don't know, the story is kind of over when the line ends, yeah. But that would be a very sad ending to a musical. So everyone comes back out, you know, confidently proud of being on the line and
one singular sensation. Yeah.
One singular.
And does the big perfect unison, you know, number at the end and hitting that. And there's always like a big, when it goes one bump and like the lights flash and you stick your leg out and points your toe. And there are just few iconic choreography moments like that. And it gets a huge applause every time. And it's the best.
Well, a big applause to you, John Marshall Jr. Thank you so much for coming on the show and having fun with us.
I'm so glad you had me and reached out and made this connection. And yeah, well, hopefully I'll see each other very soon.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Facebook just recommended me because every time I'm going to quit Facebook. And then they're like, are you sure? Here's some interesting people you might want to be friends with.
I know. That's how they get you.
And I'm, damn you, corporate media. Well, take care of yourself, John.
Take care and enjoy the inauguration.
Yes, you too.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
John Marshall Jr. lives in Chicago, just a block away from us. The irony.
I know, it's not unusual.
Just like a Chorus Line, you know, it's like they travel so far, but they're right there at home. Just like Dorothy with the ruby red slippers. Mm-hmm.
And he's right there, just up a dark and lonely stairwell. How's the line go?
Up and down and a narrow stairwell to the beat of a metronome. It wasn't very...
Someday this Chorus Line fever will be flushed from your system and you'll be like, I'm over that.
Well, so think about it is, it's like, to
it's
me...
it's been going on for a year now.
It's dovetailing with my obsession with Showgirls.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is this trauma that I have of auditioning for roles, you know, and as a actor and performer myself, you know, having gone to auditions and having a negative experience, you know, and then flipping the tables around and actually having to cast people for theatrical productions, and the success of the theatrical production is based on your ability to figure out, is there a diamond in the rough, or are you, you know, just casting with your dick? Like, are you just casting because you like the superficiality of what you see? But you can't go by that because it's about the person being able to last the production. It's about to pull things from underneath the surface. And so in terms of casting, and every actor, I encourage them, be part of a casting crew or a casting team, because then it'll really heal your trauma of being rejected to say no, because you can be the most amazing person in the world, but you might not be the right fit for that job.
Right. You might not be the right person.
But at the same time, it's hard to hear no when you know you're right for the job.
Mm.
And you have to allow people in any kind of a career, whether, you know, in an office or a graphic designer or architectural firm or whatever, or a restaurant, you know, you have to empower leadership to make the mistake of saying no to you and making the mistake of not promoting you. And I think like one thing that impressed in my other careers is when I was not promoted and they told me about that. And I just said, I don't agree with your decision, but I do want to empower and respect you to make the best decision you think is right for you.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think this is the right decision. And I'll explain to you why, but you know, you will eventually discover that on your own, or maybe I'll be wrong. And I was right. And then I later got a promotion. So,
well, there you go.
So sometimes, you know, just because it's no now doesn't mean it's not going to be yes in the future. Mm-hmm. And
we're going to take a pass.
Man's rejection is God's protection. Mm-hmm. Maybe them saying no for you now is opening up the doors for amazing new experiences down the road for you.
Oh,
and that's what I want to leave people here with, you know, is, and you know, it hurts to say no. It hurts to not be loved and appreciated for what you do. But, you know, you really can't control that sometimes, even if it's stemming from prejudice and negativity and arrogance and stupidity. That is their problem. And you are worth much more than the petty whims of a manager or an audition person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cause they're stuck with the bad decision that they made. They have to train that person. And you who are put me in the show and the rest of the crap will get solved.
I want to remind folks that we can't do this show without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today. feastoffun.com/plus, because your contribution to the show is what makes this show happen. Maybe you'd like to advertise on Feast of Fun. It's easier than ever. Just email us at mail@feastoffun or mark@feastoffun, and we'll get back with you on how the best route. And, you know, it's pennies a serving.
And for anybody who is part of our Feast of Fun Plus memberships or our Patreon memberships, you can join us after the show at our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/feastoffun. You do have to, now we're limiting the group to people who are actually supporters of the podcast, but you can continue the conversation with Mark and I and the past guests and future guests and friends of the show, and have a lot of fun and continue the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of roles have you wanted to play? Ooh. Have you ever dreamed of being in a Broadway audience?
I have, as a matter of fact.
Well, you've been. Have you ever gone to see a Broadway musical?
In New York, Broadway? No, I have not. But I've seen plenty of touring shows, you know, here in Chicago and Erie growing up. And my mother was involved in the Playhouse. So I grew up kind of like theater adjacent.
That's interesting. And so have you ever dreamed of like a role that you wanted to play, or like being cast in a role? What would
I'd
that be like?
I'd be too nervous and I'd forget my lines and stuff like that.
You'd
I don't
be like,
know.
Oh, I play the cowardly lion.
I'm more film work.
Well, you've certainly done plenty of television film work.
Reality TV,
yeah.
And, but that's just, you know, I just have to be my authentic self, and nobody does it better.
Yeah, nobody does Mark like Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness.
I know, right? Where would we be without me? Or you.
Or any of you guys.
You out there right now. It's a whole new world out there, folks.
A brand new day. Can you feel a brand new day? Can you feel a brand new day? We're going to leave you here with Carl Schmitt's big band cover of One from the musical A Chorus Line.
Bye, everybody. Bye.